In times of struggle, we must remember those who carve their own path. The pioneers, the pilgrims, the types of people who would have agreed to go into space in one of those ludicrous 1960s tin can spaceships. Those who would rather die on their feet than live on their asses. They are the
Faces of Virtue!
Greetings and welcomes, listeners, to this penultimate episode of the Crowley Time miniseries where Tom Crowley, profile those who step at least slightly out of their comfort zones in an effort to improve their lot, and the lots of those around them. This episode's Prince of Progress is Aidan Turnbull of Chodingham in County Durham, a martial arts instructor and pillar of the community who recently mobilised all of his high-kicking young students for a very special cause. Many thanks to Thomas Ellis for putting us in touch with Aidan. Hello, Aidan.
Hello, Thomas. Thank you for taking the time to talk to me today. How are you doing?
Well, it's a great pleasure. Thank you very much for asking. I'm fine, thank you. Are you having a good day?
I'm having a lovely day. Yeah, I mean, it's a slightly sort of grey overcast day here in Chodingham. But, you know, I mean, the sun is shining inwardly because I've got the chance to talk to you about the work that we're doing and about myself and just have a chat in general. So, yeah, the sun is shining inwardly, I'd say.
Well, that's a very beautiful philosophy. It sounds like you've got a very positive attitude towards life there in Chodingham, in County Durham, is it?
It is, yep, Chodingham in County Durham, Chod, as we call it. Old Chod, Choddy, and someone who's from Chodingham is, of course, a Chodder. So, yeah, I'm a Chodder through and through, eight generations as far as I'm aware. But, yep, Chodingham, County Durham, that's where I have me home.
Wonderful. Now, tell us a bit about what it is you do, because I know you're quite an institution. You're a figure of respect in the community. Tell us what position you hold.
Well, absolutely, yeah. I like to see myself a bit as the sort of prit stick that's binding Chodingham together. I'm a martial arts instructor by trade. I'm a black belt in both judo and karate, and I run the little dojo in Chodingham, which is the Dojo Ganbate Ne. And I've been running that for about 10 years now.
Wonderful. And of course, as people who've practiced self-defense martial arts will know, there's a great philosophical aspect to it. It's not just about flipping people over your shoulder, is it? It's also about aligning yourself spiritually. I imagine that comes into your work a lot.
Oh, absolutely, Thomas. Well, I think that's actually the most important thing about martial arts. I think, as we'll talk about, is that, throwing people over your shoulder, as you say, that is very important in something like judo. But it's also about sort of throwing negative emotions over your mind's shoulder, which isn't your actual physical shoulder as it was. I mean, to sort of give you a sense of where I'm coming from, I was wondering if I could tell you just a short Buddhist parable.
Oh, yes, that'd be wonderful, please.
I think they do have a lot to teach us. So if you wouldn't mind, I'm just going to tell you now the parable of the pigeons.
Parable of the pigeons. Thank you. Yes, please.
Sure thing. So once upon a time in ancient China, the emperor there, the emperor's sort of like the kind of king or the prime minister. He's sort of in charge of all the business there.
I'm familiar with emperors, yes.
Well, is the emperor of China, so just so you know that, he's quite an important character in the parable. Anyway, he was mates with some pigeons, and they lived up on the roof of his palace in a little coop up there. And, you know, they were just getting on with things, and they'd fly off and they'd fly back and all that sort of thing. And anyway, one day the emperor says to his pigeons, he says, "I want each of you to fly off and bring me a gift that will delight my senses." Now, the first pigeon, he flies off on the north wind, and he flies all the way over the Great Wall, all the way over to Mongolia, where it's proper cold, and he brings back an ice pear. Have you ever had, one of those ice pears, Tom?
I've had your average supermarket organic pear, but no, I haven't had an ice pear. No, what's that?
Well, an ice pear is usually, I mean, you can get them sometimes in a sort of covered market or somewhere like that. They're a kind of larger, whiter sort of pear, and they're usually frozen. I mean, it's a lovely fruit. It's very cold. Anyway, this first pigeon, he flies off, he brings back an ice pear in his beak, and he says, "I've brought you something to delight your sense of taste." And anyway, the emperor's all, "Oh, that's lush. That's a real treat. Thanks for that, mate." And then the second pigeon, she flies off on the west wind, and she flies all the way over the Gobi Desert, and it's proper dry there. And anyway, she comes back from the desert, and she's got a piece of carved jade in her mouth. And she says, "I've brought you something to delight your sense of vision." And the Emperor's all, "Oh, that's class, that's mint, I love jade, me, oh, that's really Chinese, cheers, pet." And the third pigeon, she flies in over on the east wind. So she heads east, and she goes all the way over the sea to Japan. Wow. And she brings back a really high-end Mitsubishi Walkman. And she says to the Emperor, "I got you this Mitsubishi Walkman with stereo headphones to delight your sense of hearing." And the Emperor's loving it. He's got three fantastic gifts, and he sent the third pigeon. He's like, "Oh, cheers, pet. Thanks for that. I can listen to all my classic UK garage CDs now when I'm out running." Mm. Now, the fourth pigeon, while this is going on, he's doing nothing. He's just sitting in his bedroom in his coop. And the Emperor, he starts to get a bit annoyed with this, and he sort of knocks on the door of the coop, and he says, "Where's my gift? Why haven't you flown off?" And the fourth pigeon, he comes out of his little house, and he looks at the Emperor, and he says, "I think you're doing a very good job, and you work yourself too hard. You need some time off. Now, I don't need to fly off on the south wind to bring you a gift that will delight your sense of self-respect." Eh? Now all the other pigeons are furious, obviously, because they've gone to all this bother.
They've gone to loads of trouble.
Yeah. I mean, like, they've flown miles, and they've been carrying these heavy objects, these, you know, sort of... I mean, one of them is carrying a big piece of electrical equipment. And so they're saying, like, "You lazy bastard, like, where do you get off with that kind of behaviour? The audacity on this lad." Now, the Emperor, he just has a little kind of smile, and he says, "The most important sense is our inner sense of well-being and self-esteem. This little lad has the right idea, and his gift is way better than all the shite that you've got me. I'm going to make him the Chancellor of the Exchequer." So that's the parable of the pigeons there, yeah.
That's the end of the parable.
That is the end of the parable, yeah.
I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, I'd love to hear your perspective on that, because to my ear, and maybe this is just very Western of me, in a sort of Judeo-Christian tradition, but to my mind, that parable seems to suggest, are you a feckless, selfish idiot who cannot live up to his commitments? If yes, just sort of flatter somebody's sense of self-importance and you will get away with your behavior indefinitely. Is that how you read the story?
Well, I mean, that's a reading, Tom, and of course you're entitled to that reading. I think that reading is incorrect myself. I think it's quite stupid, and I think it's also quite hurtful.
And of course it's your right to have that opinion of my reading as well.
That is true, yeah. But I think the point of the story, Tom, is that the pigeons didn't need to go on those big journeys to get those extravagant gifts. What they actually just needed to do was to stay inside and actually learn some home truths. That's why we call them home truths, because you don't find them elsewhere. You find them inside. So it's all about sort of inner calmness and an inner sense of well-being.
On that topic, you're taking these philosophical ideas and you are translating them into a kind of a physical, unlike the fourth pigeon, you're doing something real with them, in that you are teaching a discipline, you're teaching physical fitness, and self-defense to young people. Is that right?
Yeah. So I teach martial arts. I teach mostly karate and a bit of judo now and then as well. My wife is more of a judo enthusiast than I am, but I like to myself as more of a mixed martial arts practitioner.
I've seen that you offer several classes for different age groups. You've got a sort of 6 to 8 years old. You've got 8 to 10. 10 to 12. And so that seems to be all the courses you offer. So is that the age group that you cater to the most?
Well, I mean, the dojo does run classes up to the sort of senior sessions, but sadly nobody's really signed on for those. At the moment, what we've got is we've got three kind of age groups. The first ones, they're all based on fish. So the first one is little tiddlers, and little tiddlers are kind of like your 4 to 6s. After that, you move on to minnows. The minnows are kind of your 6 to 8s. And then 9 to 12, they're your koi carps. And the koi carps are sort
big
of...
big chaps, yeah.
They're sort of the bigger boys, yeah. And girls as well. But, so, I mean, mostly, I'd say my students are between the age range of about 7 and 9. That is where they tend to cluster. But we are trying to actively recruit adults.
In the community there, yeah. Have you always sort of had that community spirit? You said that you've 8 generations of the Turnbull family... have grown up in Chottingham. So did you feel that sense of togetherness, of spirituality from a very young age?
Well, you know, I'd love to be able to say that, you know, I sort of karate chopped me way out of my mother's uterus, but I mean, that just wouldn't be true. I mean, my family background, actually, I come from quite a difficult background, Tom. I'm going to sort of level you with you there. I had a 1920s childhood in the late 1980s and early 1990s.
Right.
Because my father, Aidan Senior, he worked in a local industrial heritage museum. Now, I don't know if you're familiar with these kind of places. You might have gone to one of them on a school trip.
Yes, I've seen a few, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, basically, like a place that used to have an industry, that'll close down. And so they open up a museum to say, oh, this is what we used to do. Like, we used to, you know, like, dig coal, or we used to, like, dig iron, or these sort of things. So my father worked at one of those, and he played a coal miner. And what he'd have to do is that there'd be sort of school parties and elderly people, and they'd come round. He'd stand at the pit head, and he'd push a little cart full of coal about 6 feet. And then he'd say to the people, he'd say in his sort of miner's voice, he'd be like, it's a proper hard job being a miner. Like, do you think you can push this big thing of coal up this bank? And of course, he'd usually point at, like, you know, the sort of jack the ladder of the group, and they'd sort of try and they'd struggle.
Yeah, the widest boy in the group.
The widest boy in the group. And there's, or sometimes, you know, to be cruel, he'd point at, like, the weediest lad and, you know, he'd say, do you think you can push this coal up that ramp? And they'd try pushing it, and it'd be proper difficult because, I mean, sometimes he'd have the brakes on so they couldn't do it. And then he'd laugh and he'd say, see, it's not so difficult being a miner. And he did this. I mean, he'd be doing that about 15 times per hour as the tour groups were coming through. So he was pushing this thing. He was doing his speech, pushing this thing, doing his speech. And I think that sort of psychologically destroyed him, that kind of repetitive, quite unpleasant behaviour. And, I mean, he used to come back to the house. And my mum was, she was actually an executive with a software marketing company.
Right.
But when she came back to the house, because my father had gone crazy, she had to get into a miner's housewife outfit and be doing some sort of 1920s chore. So she'd have to put away her marketing plans and things like that. And she'd have to just put a load of grey socks through a mangle, or be cutting out some sort of pastry shapes or something like that, because he'd come in, he'd be covered in coal, he'd be wearing his three-piece miner's tuxedo, and he'd be, where's me dinner, woman? And she'd have to, you know, sort of prepare the dinner for us, and he'd summon me and my sisters, and he'd give us all clips round the ear. I mean, it was very difficult, but I mean...
That sounds so... It's like you've had to sort of stage manage a Ken Loach film that nobody's filming.
Exactly. I mean, we were essentially being psychologically tyrannised by this man. At the same time, there was a sense of the greater good, because he was telling people about our company and our region's industrial heritage. So, I mean, even though it did, I think, you know, leave lasting psychological scars on me and my sisters. I mean, I think... Me more than my sisters, because I got the worst of it. My sisters are both helicopter pilots now, so I think they're both fine. But
that's wonderful.
Well, no, it is great. I mean, you know, they work for...
Are they Coast Guard or are they private hire?
Private hire mostly, yeah.
Oh, well, I think, well done to them.
Well, a big thing that sort of Clarice does is that she flies the lads over to the races and stuff like that. So, you know, when you've got the Galway races or something, she's mostly flying kind of quite a sort of, you know, beefy-faced red men to and from various race courses. But, I mean, she loves it. I mean, they live for the blades, they say, you know. But I think all of us were seeking an escape. And for me, the moment came, really, when I went round to my friend Liam's house. And Liam was, you know, one of those lads who'd be on Microsoft Paint and he'd be drawing like kind of an obscene thing on there. And, you know, he had a bit of a devil may care attitude. But
yes, I know the type, yeah.
But anyway, I remember when I was about 8 years old, I went round to Liam's house, and he introduced me to something that I think had a huge influence on who I became, which was the Steven Seagal film, Under Siege. Have you seen Under Siege, Thomas?
No, I haven't, but I'm aware of Seagal. You're a Steven Seagal fan?
I'm a huge Steven Seagal fan. I mean, I think kind of particularly Under Siege. Steven Seagal plays a kind of, I guess you could call him a kind of Cajun man. He's doing this voice. It's sort of not clear whether it's a kind of African-American voice or something else, but, you know, it's the early 90s, that was all right. Mm. And he's cutting the stews on this ship. But it turns out that's just a cover because he's actually the best in the world at knacking people. And Gary Busey, for a very convoluted reason, it takes over the ship in drag, and Steven has to, you know, put the world to rights, really. So I'd never seen a Steven Seagal film before. And just, I mean, Steven Seagal, just to give you a sense of sort of his dimensions, he's about 6'5" tall, and he's about 4.5 feet wide, and he's about 4.5 feet deep. So, I mean, the cubic area of this guy is quite large.
It's a massive cube, isn't it? I mean, cubic is right.
He's just like a huge sort of cuboid specimen. And I mean,
with a ponytail coming off the back.
With a ponytail, just a beautiful ponytail.
And like a lovely horse.
Well, exactly, like a lovely horse. But like with a lovely horse, you've got to be careful around Steven, because I mean, he might be eating out your hand, but if you get behind his legs, he'll kick. I mean, not to put too, you know, to call a spade, he's a big lad.
He's a big chap, yeah.
He's a big cube, but he moves like water. And there's something beautiful about watching just such a large, chunky boy moving that beautifully, that fluidly, watching the universe rearrange itself around his ponytailed immensity.
Well, that clearly had a very, very serious impact on you. So, but I'd love to hear more about the dojo that you run and the lessons that you try and to drill into these kids, you know, to try and shape them up spiritually and physically as well.
Absolutely. Well, the dojo that I run, Dojo Ganbatte Ne, Ganbatte Ne is, that's Japanese, Thomas, for do your best.
Yeah, I'm aware, yeah.
Yeah, Dojo Ganbatte Ne was, we founded it about 10 years ago. I looked at what was happening in Chottingham and, you know, there was a lot of petty crime on the street and there was a lot of petty behaviour, if I'm honest with you. And the kids, they were running riot. You know, you had people sort of scrumping for apples. You had people knocking old fellas' caps off.
I find that disgusting.
It is disgusting, actually, yeah. And I mean, you have people making sort of comments about dog's weight.
Oh.
That dog needs some more exercise, that sort of thing. You know, like just kids jumping in puddles, splashing the side of things. You know, writing like, you know, category C swear words in marker pen on the side of the bus stop.
People use that bus stop.
Exactly.
It's sort of like a bit of a northeastern version of The Warriors that you're painting for me here.
You know, it almost was. And just like in The Warriors, where they have to navigate this dystopian environment, but it's only through their control of their own bodies and their own love for each other and their city that they survive.
Yep.
I think that's what I did with the kids in Chod. I set the dojo up to kind of get kids off the streets and basically train them up in physical combat.
Well,
I wanted these kids to sort of stop being, you know, thoughtless delinquents and become heavily disciplined killing machines.
And wonderful training, I'm sure you do provide. So how do you go about teaching these kids? How do you incentivize them? What's the process from the moment a child arrives in your care to when they graduate as a sort of a small pudgy kind of murder machine?
The thing is about martial arts is that it comes from a very sort of glorious lineage. And sort of my lineage goes back all the way to the sort of Shaolin Temple, where that started with Buddhist monks. Basically, when you're a Buddhist monk, a lot of what you do is just sort of sit there meditating and feeling quite smug about having all the answers. And that's pretty good, but it is quite dull. So these lads, they were just sitting around all the time. They sort of had to think of various ways to pass the time. I mean, one thing is they do these big pictures with sand and then they blow them out. Completely pointless. Mm. They were also being bullied a lot because, you know, they're wearing this sort of orange getup. And all the other lads.
They're all bald as well, so they'd
be going down the high street in medieval China, and you'd just have people come up to them and go, "Slap head!" And they'd slap their head, and the monks, they'd have nothing, they'd just be there going, "What was that? That's shocking. I cannot believe that." But they had to sort of think of a more proactive way to sort of deal with this.
Yeah, because you don't want to be putting up with that every time you walk down the high street and go to the medieval Chinese equivalent of like Rumbelows or something.
Well, yeah, exactly. Or kind of, you know, the Quicksave or, you know, the sort of Woolworths or something like that. I mean, they're kind of Chinese equivalent, you know. But they had to sort of find a way to sort of channel all this nervous, frustrated, angry energy. And they developed a very spiritual way of knacking people. And this sort of spread all over the world, really. So I'm part of that lineage.
Mm, of course, of course. But it's time for us, I think, to talk about the reason that I'm speaking to you today here on Faces of Virtue. Of course, we're concerned with local activism and charitable causes and similar positive campaigns. And you yourself have been involved in a very significant charitable cause lately, isn't that right?
That's true, yeah. I've been organising the 72-hour chop-a-thon for Wakelham.
Now, chop-a-thon, what does this entail?
Well, the chop-a-thon is sort of karate chopping. So it's usually something that you might have at like a martial arts meeting where practitioners and students will just chop for a set number of time with each stroke being in perfect precision.
Right.
Or each blow or each stance. And the chop-a-thon that we did was a karate chop-a-thon and we did it for 72 hours.
Wow, that must be exhausting. And these are your students. These are very young children just standing there and just chopping the hell out of each other for 72 straight hours.
That is exactly what happened. Yeah, they were very young children, just non-stop karate chopping for 72 hours in the Chottingham Marketplace. We did
it's
actually
the sort of scene that, in my mind, it's the sort of thing you might see in the middle of a montage in an Adam Curtis film. Like, it feels very sort of dystopian, the image of these uniformed children just drubbing each other for a sustained period. You know, was that the experience you had of it?
Well, absolutely. It's funny you mention Mr. Curtis, actually, because he got in touch. He was like, "I've heard what you're doing. I'm going to put some Aphex Twin over that, and I'm going to use it in my new documentary, which is about how two obscure kind of computer scientists in the early 1960s are actually responsible for grime music." And I said, "Well, that sounds absolutely unwatchable, and I think you're running on fumes by this point, Mr. Curtis, but you know, fair enough. I can't stop you. That's you know, just the local council."
And it's a lot of fun for the kids as well to be in a sort of 7-hour documentary on BBC Four.
I mean, if there's one thing I know about kids, is that they love Adam Curtis. You know, their little faces just light up when, you know, he's explaining about how, you know, the former Soviet Union allocated goods and services and how that's actually like you know, what Microsoft Excel does now. But we also had a lot of, you know, sort of positive reception from the local people. We raised a great deal of money. And we were also sponsored by an energy drink.
Are you allowed to say which one, or is there some sort of NDA?
I'm actively encouraged to say which one.
Which one was it?
It's Thrust, which you might know from its slogan, "Grasp the Grape."
Sorry, Thrush?
Thrust.
So, Thrust. Sorry,
Thrust,
I misheard you.
Yeah. Grasp the Grape. It's a grape-based energy drink. Great taste, that's what they say. But anyway, Thrust sponsored us as well. And the kids were there for, you know, 3 days straight underneath the statue to the Boer War criminals in Chottingham Marketplace. And they were just, you know, chopping away there, just chopping and chopping and chopping.
Well, it sounds both horrifying and very impressive. And this was for a charitable campaign, you said. Tell us about that. What was the cause you were supporting?
Yeah, so the cause we're supporting, the registered charity, I hope you sort of share the information with your listeners.
Absolutely, is,
It's Let's Send Wakelham Up Everest. Now, Wakelham is one of our students at the dojo. He is a chronically ill child, but he's such a little trier. You know, I mean, his stance is terrible because of his condition. You know,
which is
well, so. I mean, you know, not to go into too great medical detail, but Wakelham was very sadly, when he was born, they discovered that he'd been born with three lungs.
Oh.
Now, you'd think, you know, three lungs, that's that's sort of better, you know.
Might be an advantage, yeah.
Might be
yeah.
an advantage having one spare, but actually it's not, because he's permanently breathing so much oxygen in that his brain can't cope with it. So he's permanently very dizzy and lightheaded. So his hand-eye coordination's terrible, you know, he's sort of not very good on his sort of memory and recall.
No, no.
But he has a warrior spirit. You know, sometimes I'll just be teaching the students, correcting the stance, and then I'll just feel a flurry of tiny blows against my shin, and it'll be wee Callum there just, you know, sort of going to town, pounding on my shin, trying to sort of bring me down. But, you know, I tower over him like a colossus, so there's nothing doing there, really.
Like a Steven Seagal in some ways.
Almost like a Steven Seagal over perhaps a Vern Troyer.
Or Danny DeVito, possibly.
Danny DeVito, or one of those. Perhaps, yeah, someone more current. And, I mean, if you don't look at the cast of his face, he does have a sort of DeVito-ian sort of gleam to his eye. But anyway, Wade Callum recently is very sad, you know, because the techniques he was learning in the dojo, the deep breathing, things like that, they were actually helping quite a lot. But then he was hospitalised, and I'm afraid to say that the doctors found a fourth lung.
Oh, my God. So, sorry. So everyone assumed, and he'd been examined before, and they'd found three lungs and thought, well, there's your problem.
Yeah.
And they found he had since grown another lung, or this was always there, they hadn't known about it, or?
I was just hiding behind another internal organ, really. And I think, you know, it was just shoddy doctoring the first time. And, you know, his great dream, because he loves two things. He loves karate and he loves mountains. And his great dream is to go up Everest. Because that's the
biggest
mountain.
The trip that you were funding through the 72-hour Chopathon.
Yeah, the Chopathon is dedicated to sending Callum up Everest because, you know, I mean, partly it'll be a treat for him. It'll be a nice holiday. But also the very, very thin air is going to be good for his lungs.
So there's less oxygen getting in. He's getting a normal amount of oxygen, but he's just consuming per volume a lot more air, a lot more gas.
Absolutely, because, I mean, if you go up Everest, I mean, you have to sort of physically step over hundreds of bodies of, you know, sort of people who are having midlife crises, and they sort of get up there and then they can't breathe, and they're sort of just left up there as a sort of monument to man's folly. Yeah. But Wade Callum, you know, he's going to be up there, he's going to be loving it. He's, you know, because he's going to be a normal boy up there.
So you've held the Chopathon and you've raised the funds, and so he's presumably setting off very soon.
Well, I mean, we still have got a while to go, actually, which is why, you know, usually I wouldn't sort of dignify this kind of program with me time. But the sort of reason that I did take you up on your offer was because we do need a lot more money. He's going to need a lot of Sherpas to sort of bring all his special medical equipment up.
Of course.
And, I mean, you must know this as well, like, Sherpas don't come cheap.
No, of course.
No, not if you want to get one of the good ones. So, yeah, we're doing a few more stunts, and we're hoping that's going to push us over the fundraising goal.
Ah, so there's still more fundraising to come, I see. So what else have you got planned?
So you might have seen this, actually. Have you ever seen people like karate chopping planks, you know, sort of
chop them in half, and they're, with their inner discipline, they're able to push through the pain and the physical improbability, and they smash the wooden board or the concrete block in half just with their flesh.
Well, absolutely. And we're sort of going to sort of build on that premise, and we're actually going to build a small semi-detached house purely using martial arts. So we're going to have people doing the timber. We're going to have people like smashing up the concrete to make, you know, remake concrete, essentially, you know, getting the slates into sort of perfect squares, you know, doing the cavity wall insulation, those kind of things. And yeah, just purely using martial arts. So we're going to be doing that in three weeks time. And we're preparing for that. That's the next big stunt. And we hope that's going to sort of push us over the edge, really, because I'm going to be honest with you, Tom, I'm completely out of ideas, you know. And we've got to get this wee lad up that mountain.
Well, it sounds like a wonderful campaign, and I really, really do hope that wee Callum does make it up there to the highest point of Everest. Not least because if everything you told me about his condition is correct, then he probably hasn't got that long left. So I do hope that you are able to give him that experience before he overinflates himself fatally.
Well, that's exactly the sort of problem. I didn't really want to sort of say it because some of the boys will be listening to this. I mean, I know, you know what kids are like. They usually listen to, they love podcasts, they love Adam Curtis, but they might be listening to this. So I didn't really want to say that, but yeah, I mean, the thing is, like, once they found the fourth lung, the doctor did that thing, you know, where you tug on the collar and you go, sort of did a face. So, I mean, that was the diagnosis, really, which I thought was a bit unprofessional. But
you expect some sort of letter, an official diagnosis, or
yeah, just like a sort of letter coming through, going, "Your child's dying," like something like that, rather than like a sort of bit of mime, really. But, you know, I mean, I don't know what kind of a day he was having. So, you know, maybe it was a hard day for him.
Well, it's clearly a very worthy cause, and you've done such great work trying to raise the money for it. And I'm delighted to call you a face of virtue as part of this series. And I wish you luck with all of your further stunts, your further martial arts-based efforts. But before we say goodbye, is there any other word of wisdom, an adage or some sort of advice you have for our listeners of how to live their lives, things that can make the world a better place?
Absolutely. Well, I'm very glad that you've asked me that, Thomas, because, you know, I think fundamentally what it comes down to is that thing I talked about earlier with the pigeons, you know, about that sense of self-worth and respect. I think if everybody learnt martial arts, there'd be world peace tomorrow. Now, a lot more people would be violently beaten to death over very petty personal grievances, but there'd be no more warfare, and I think that would be perhaps a more dangerous world, but I think it would ultimately be a more rewarding world to live in.
Aidan Turnbull, thank you very much for speaking to me.
Thank you very much, Thomas. Take care.
Take care.
Unfortunately, while I'd have liked to link all you fine listeners to the crowdfunding website for Let's Get Wee Callum Up Everest, I'm afraid to say that it has been indefinitely shut down after footage from the 72-hour chopathon was featured in Adam Curtis's recent 9-hour documentary Algorithm Slut, and was subsequently traced to the dojo Gambate Ne by the authorities. Still, best wishes to Aidan, and here's hoping that the inquest is short and painless. Very much the opposite of the 72-hour chopathon. Once again, I'd like to thank Thomas Ellis for putting us in touch with Aidan. He's a writer and researcher who has contributed to CBBC's Horrible Histories and BBC Radio 4's podcast Homeschool History with Greg Jenner, available on BBC Sounds and all podcast apps now. Thank you all for joining me again in this little eddy on the current of Crowley time. We have one more episode of Faces of Virtue with a very special final guest coming in 2 weeks, and we will return to the usual sketch smorgasbord shortly thereafter. If you're enjoying Faces of Virtue, why not let me know on Twitter, @atomcrowley. While I'm not charging my Patreon supporters for this mini-series, I've been delighted that quite a few people are still signing up over at patreon.com/crowleytime. It's so encouraging to see and gets me right jazzed up to get back to crafting more gorgeous sketch comedy for you lovely lot. If you want to go and sign up as a supporter, you won't be charged until the next full Crowley Time episode is released. But in the meantime, you can still enjoy all the
bonus materials of times past.
Whether you're in a position to support the show financially or not, listen up. I want to ask a favour. Get on whatever app you're using to listen to this and give the show a nice review. Go on. I'd love it if you did that. Right now. Most importantly, stay tuned to this feed for our fourth and final edition of
Faces of Virtue! Oh.